Hey, welcome. Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Glad you could join me. We have a great show in store for you. A little bit of everything, including calls from you on any subject related to birds, bird dogs, and bird hunting. I'll be taking the Stump the Host questions in the first half of this program. In the second half, we'll welcome Dr. Tim Hunt, sled dog racer, veterinarian, and developer of my favorite dog food. We'll be asking questions and relaying some of your questions as well about dog food, diet, nutrition, and conditioning, and all the other related subjects. So stand by. As I've said before, put two dog owners in a room and you'll get three opinions about dog food. So stick around for that. Of course, a public access tip where you can hunt for free. All you need to invest is boot, leather, and fuel to get there. A hunting tip for your dog handling and that sort of thing. It's all coming up right here on the Upland Nation podcast. First, though, just a quick reminder that if you got a little bit of season left, I'd sure love to hear how you're doing out there. Over here, we've got more snow, and it's a little bit tough going, especially for Flick. He's running the last few days of the season with a boot on his right rear. Like I told you before, he pulled a nail out. We're still coping with that, but it seems to be healing pretty well. Thanks for all your good wishes, by the way. And Flick says, rough as well. I'm looking ahead to the training goals for this season as well. For him, it is steady to wing shot and fall. And for me, it's shooting better so that the fall actually takes place. Yeah, I think I'm going to take a couple lessons. And if you've never taken a lesson, consider doing it. I've been a musician, I've been a writer, I've been all sorts of other things, and I've learned over the years that the experts in teaching can help you be more expert in learning. Find a good one, seek them out, lay out the dollars, it'll be well worth it in the long run. We got the tools for our training program, except for those Bob Whites. If anybody has any hard-flying Bob Whites here in Oregon, give me a shout. I need a few, probably more than a few. How about yourself, though? What are your goals? We'll be talking about that down the road, too. So get ready with your answers, because I'd love to take your calls on that topic. And just a couple quick reminders here. Sageandbreaker.com is where you get all the highest caliber gun care and cleaning products. If you missed out and didn't get in on the stuff at Christmas, well, most of those products are back in stock now. Sign up for the mailing list at sageandbreaker.com and you won't miss out on anything next time new products come out or next time there's a promotion and a discount. It's all at sageandbreaker.com. And another shout out, thank you folks at dogtra.com for that incredible product, the T&B dual collar. One handheld, two sets of buttons for two collars. Whether you're running two dogs or two collars on one dog, front and back, like I'm working with Flick, it's all right there in front of you. No toggling back and forth. Dog one is one set of buttons. Dog two is another set of buttons. Simple, easy. I need both. All right, so I told you that I would take any questions you have on almost any subject related to the stuff we love, birds, bird hunting, and bird dogs. And the first one comes over the Facebook page from Mark Cross Jr. How you doing, Mark? I am hoping that you are out there enjoying the tail end of the season. You're asking, though, about training during the summer when the state shuts down land. Yeah, I know the feeling. I sat on a committee here in Oregon to get that fixed. You know, up until about 6 or 7 years ago, we couldn't train with our own game birds anywhere, private, public, anywhere in between, because that's what the law said. Well, we got it squared away here, but even if there is a prohibition in your state, there are other places you can train. Of course, the first thing you need to do is figure out whether you need birds or not. If you don't need birds, the options are a little bit more open to you. If you need to plant birds, then you're probably going to be limited to pigeons. And if you don't have a supplier, good luck. If you do have a loft of your own, all the better. But let's talk about where to go with all that stuff. There are private properties out there that might welcome you in one way or another. You know, if you're in a rural area, you can find somebody with some agricultural land that they're, you know, that is CRP or something like that, that they might be willing to lease to you, rent to you, or maybe just let you use periodically in exchange for, you know, some sort of a quid pro quo. So drive around a little bit and ask permission just like you would if you're looking for private ground to hunt. Some of the bigger county parks may have some open space that you can use. And if I'm using a public place like that, I like to go really early in the morning. About daylight is when I like to get there. That's before... Oh, all the, that's my reminder to talk about that kind of stuff. That's when the joggers are not up yet. That's when the kids playing in the athletic fields are not there yet. So take a look at some of those big parks. And finally, and this may be your best bet, it is for most of us, join some of the local dog clubs and dog training clubs, depending on where you are. It could be NAVDA, NASTRA, it could be AKC, whatever it is. Many of those organizations either have access to ground or they have their own ground. So check some of those out, and good luck, Mark, because you're in the same boat as a lot of us, and good. I hope you find something nearby that you can use. All right, now let's go to the phones. John Bilodeau, you're calling from somewhere in Pennsylvania, it looks like. Am I right on that? Welcome to the show.
Yeah, you're right. I'm from St. Mary's, Pennsylvania. It's in the north central part of the state up in the Allegheny Mountains.
So am I safe to guess you might do a little grouse hunting?
That's mainly what I do. That's what I started hunting, but I hunt grouse, pheasants, woodcock. Just got back from Nebraska in November. I was out there for a week.
How'd that go for you?
Pretty good, actually. Still a lot of standing crops because it's been so wet out there. They really couldn't get the corn cut and stuff, but we found a fair amount of pheasants. We were averaging three coveys of quail a day, and we found a few sharptails. We didn't find any prairie chickens, but wasn't really expected to. We were kind of in the southwest corner, so not really prairie chicken country.
Wow, that sounds like a pretty good hunt in itself. Three species, and yeah, I know. I dealt with the crop situation in two other states as well, so glad you had so much success. What kind of dog you running these days?
I run a little Welland setters.
Nice. And out there, let's see, were you dealing with cockle burrs and maybe foxtails in the coat at the end of the day?
Foxtails a lot. Some cockle burrs, but not too much of those. But foxtails, hemp.
Oh.
Ran into a lot of hemp out there.
Yeah, it's the crop of choice these days in a lot of places, including right here.
Yeah.
Well, interesting. Were you allowed to hunt any of that stuff, or were you just driving past it?
No, that stuff there, the hemp, from what I understand from the guy I was hunting with, was left over. It's wild now. It was left over from crops they planted back there during World War II.
Oh, wow.
And it's actually, it's not... the marijuana hemp, it's the hemp that they use for making rope and twine and stuff like that. But yeah, he said it's actually wild from way back then. There's not a lot of it, but man, is it a son of a gun to get through.
Wow, that's fascinating. Over here, that's the very, well, they're doing both out here in Oregon. It's legal to grow both.
Right.
But the hot one these days is the commercial version like that. And it's, it's taken over. And if you're a horse owner, the problem you face is you can't find hay because nobody's growing it anymore. They're growing hemp instead.
Oh.
Okay, well, I said we weren't going to get too deep into the weeds. Pardon the pun on that one, but we did. But you had a question for me about, well, let's just call it more mature hunting challenges. Why don't you ask it?
Well, I'm 66 now, and I've started noticing over the last couple of years, like I said, I'm up here in the Allegheny Mountains. Most of my prime grouse hunting areas are at 2,000 to 2,500 feet, and you have to park it about 500 to 700 feet and then walk in. And I don't care what they say about erosion or anything else, the Allegheny Mountains are getting higher. They're not getting shorter.
Well, I'm pretty sure I know about what you're, how old you are, and I'm not too far behind you there. And here's what I've been doing. In fact, I need to share this with everybody. It's been a revelation. I've done a couple things, and I'm not judging you because I've never met you. I don't know what you look like or anything else. And barring all the other serious physical challenges that you might face or anybody else might face, I have found in the last couple of years, chukar hunting, where we start at 4,000 feet and go to 9,000 feet, what has helped me most has been what has helped everybody climbing hills for the last million years, and that is getting in better shape. I know it's easier said than done, but here are the two things that I've learned. Number one, you can get in shape by going to the gym every day and working out for an hour or two or five. And then you can also cut back on caloric consumption. And I've lost 25 pounds in the last 6 or 7 months. And when I'm climbing those hills now, I'm leaving the guys who are half my age in the dust anymore because of that 25 pounds of dead weight that I've been dragging around for season after season after season. All right, so getting in shape is one thing. Then there's all the stuff that comes with age that might be described as cunning and guile. I'm not a big grouse hunter, and I've certainly not hunted the same country you have, but I wonder, have you looked seriously at any of the topographic maps, John? Can you find more roads that maybe take you a little bit higher?
Well, that's the problem with a lot of the places I hunt. There are roads going in, but it's start at 700 feet and spend a half hour walking to 2,500 feet or walk the road in for 2.5 miles.
Yeah. And,
the cover in between isn't grouse cover. You know, it's like,
yeah.
Our big problem we have back here right now is our grouse population is dwindling just mainly from lack of habitat. They haven't been doing enough cutting.
Mm-hmm.
So the habitat that's left is, that's any good, is pretty much back in. And it's not really that the habitat's that great. It's that most hunters won't go that far to chase them.
Yeah, and you're not alone. And it sounds, I hate to draw the analogy again, but it sounds like chukar hunting. You know, anymore these days, we just pack a lot of water and expect the first hour to be climbing, not hunting.
Right.
And you may just have to get over that fact mentally. You know, the other thing is, roads, if there was a road built, it was built so that it would, you know, so that the, you know, whatever was using it wouldn't have to work too hard. Just like the old days with railroads, the incline had to be a certain grade, but no greater than that.
Right.
Sometimes walking 2 miles on a road is better than a half mile straight up the hill. And then there are, you know, just in terms of general habitat, searching for habitat, are you familiar? I wish I could remember who it was, but there, you know, if you just Google on the internet, Google, grouse hunting maps, there's an outfit, and I want to say that she is in Upper Michigan, but she makes topographic/satellite photo maps of all grouse hunting areas, and she is up to date on those things. So if you buy one, you know that was cut 4 years ago because it's labeled that way, and that was cut 12 right. years ago, etc., etc. And you know, again, that might just save you a few miles of walking over a season, and maybe put you into some more birds that way. But I think fundamentally you're in the same boat most of us are, and that is, if you're willing and able to walk a little bit farther than you used to. Now we sound like geezers, don't we? Boy, back in day, you could close the door and you could have a point before you got shells in the gun. I just don't think we're going to see a lot of that anymore. And you're just going to have to, you know, get in shape, pack carefully, and walk a little bit farther.
That's like this morning. I went pheasant hunting this morning. Our pheasant season here runs until the end of February, but any birds you find now aren't anywhere near where the majority of the hunters hunt. they've been pushed back, pushed up, pushed down. And the area I was hunting this morning was kind of like that. You have to park one place and then walk down into this valley, hunt the valley, and then walk back up out. I can hunt that almost any day of the week I want to and find nobody else but me down there.
You know, you bring up an interesting point. I remember being told this, 30 years ago. I was interviewing Jim Zumbo, who was probably the most popular big game hunting writer in the Outdoor Life magazine stable at the time. And he said, especially crowded weekends and opening weekend and closing weekend, don't go where you think the elk are. Go where you think the elk are going to run to after they're chased right there by everybody else. And, you know, it's a lesson for all of us, even in the bird hunting world, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have this one area that I hunt pheasants in, and once it gets to be after Christmas, I go in, park, walk out on a ridge where I can survey probably 3/4 of the area and look and see, okay, I know nobody's going there, and I know nobody's going here, and I doubt if anybody's been down there, and that's where I head for.
Love
and
it.
9 times out of 10, that's where the birds are.
Yeah, that's not going to help you with your grouse hunting, but that's going to help with the pheasants for sure. And, you know, maybe it will, now that I think about it. If you see somebody parked somewhere, maybe you go to the other end of that place or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, good. And did you find any birds on that last hunt?
I found one this morning.
Good for you.
Yeah.
That's one more than I found this morning. All I did this morning was feed birds.
We're having ridiculous weather right now. It's actually 60 degrees here today. And I figured I didn't care if I found anything or not. I wasn't letting the 60 degree day in the middle of January get by without going out.
Yeah, absolutely. And good on you. I wish I could say the same. Hey, thanks for being on the program. Great talking with you, John. And good luck next season as well.
Well, thank you.
I think that's inspiring in a lot of ways, and I'm glad you're still with us. By the way, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast, and I am Scott Linden, your host. Thanks for listening. Steve Robbins asks a question via the Facebook page. He asks, how do you get your dog on enough birds to develop consistency? Well, you know, the first way is to hunt them a lot, especially on wild birds if you can. But if you don't, then buy some birds, keep some birds for yourself, and expose them on a daily basis. The reason I keep my pigeons is pretty basic. They are on the other end of the property from my dog, which is also a good idea. But also because anytime I'm going out in that general direction, I can grab a bird or two, put it in the pocket of my coat, and then work my dog in one way or more on one or two birds here and there. And as you know, dog training works better in drips and drabs than it does in 2-hour and 3-hour blocks. So if you have quick access to birds, it makes that a little bit more possible. All right, so we're back to the phones here. Ryan Brady is calling. Ryan, where are you calling from?
Jacksonville, North Carolina.
Jackson, is that anywhere near Snow Hill and my friend's Happy Jack?
It's not too far from Snow Hill. It's a little bit of a drive, but I've been through there before.
You know, I've been talking to the guys at Happy Jack in one way or another for 10 years. They've never had snow in Snow Hill.
That's true.
maybe that's the irony of the name right there. So,
yeah.
So what kind of dogs you running these days, Ryan?
I have a poodle pointer.
Hey, good on you. We're somewhat related, not because I own any, but because I train with a lot of poodle pointer owners out here in the West. And how old is your dog?
He's 4.5.
Mm. Finally getting his brain cells, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's a good dog. He's the best dog I've ever had.
Yeah, well, that's spectacular and good for you. How was your season this year?
Well, our season isn't technically over yet, but so far we've been to a preserve a couple times. We've been out hunting for wild birds a couple times, but we tend to be chasing ghosts when we do that out here in eastern North Carolina. So I have seen a couple of woodcock, but we haven't gotten any points on them yet. It hasn't gotten cold enough to really push them down.
Well, so the best may be yet to come.
Yeah, and as time goes on, you know, I got into this looking for quail, And the more that I can't find them, the more it seems to be pushing us towards looking for woodcock, because we do happen to see them pretty much every year, sometime in January.
Are you finding those on the same ground that you were hoping to find bobwhites?
So not in the exact same places. You know, out here in eastern North Carolina, it's wet.
Yeah.
In a lot of places. So we tend to just shift over towards the wetter areas when we're looking for those. Or, you know, if we get a good rain or there's certain places out here on the game lands where you can go where it gets fairly wet next to some of the swamps and ponds, and we'll find them out there. But, I mean, when we're looking for bobwhites, we're looking for them in some of the thicker stuff anyway in the pine forest. And everywhere you go, there's a swamp somewhere.
Yeah. In fact, that'd be a great name for a song now that I think about it. You know, and your question has to do with finding wild birds. So the first thing I'm thinking of, by the way, that is the question. How are you going to find more wild birds on public land in North Carolina? Am I right on that?
Yeah. I mean, you said what was the hardest thing. I think the comment on online.
Yeah.
What was the hardest thing for your training? And everyone, you know, I read a lot. I talk to a lot of people, and they'll tell you, well, wild birds will teach a dog what they need to know, you know, to finish.
Yeah.
And when you can't ever find a wild bird, it seems like, how do you get that training for your dog? How do you get that exposure to your dog if you can't find them where you live?
Well, you know, you're not alone. You know, I mean, this is a constant challenge for everybody. And I just talked about it a few minutes ago. I'm going to talk about it again in a slightly different context right here. And that is, if there are many reasons one cannot find wild birds on public land to train a dog. Number one, the land may be closed to that sort of thing. Number two, there may not be any wild birds that time of year, whatever it is. So you're going to have to make do with store-bought birds of one sort or another. And if you can keep training pigeons, it's a good start. And, you know, I'm not going to get into the debate over whether pigeons are the same as bobwhites or the same as woodcock or the same as, wild pheasants, but you got to start somewhere, and you can keep pigeons easily. They're tough, they're resilient, and most of the time they'll come back. Although if you ask me, in the last few weeks, my loft is getting skinnier and skinnier, and I don't know why yet. But starting with pigeons and then graduating to other game birds, if you can find them, if you can buy them from a local hatchery or something like that, or if you're a member of a club, often a club will keep birds or know where to find birds that you can then buy on a, you know, 5-bird, 10-bird basis. So those are all things you can do, but you are going to have to lay out some bucks in one way or another, unless you have a rich uncle who's willing to do it for you. Have you looked into any of those options yet? Are you a member of the one of your NAVDA chapters with a poodle pointer? I would hope that the breeder strongly suggested that.
You'd be surprised. There's just a bunch of the older generation out here that aren't NAVDA folks, but they're good bird dog folks. They know a bunch. I've been lucky to meet them and meet up with them at preserves and get some time with them. And that helped me out, you know, to take me to that next level when NAVDA ran its course for us. I haven't looked into pigeons, but and we don't really have clubs out here. The hunting clubs out here are generally deer and turkey. Mm-hmm. So what we do have, though, are preserves, and we have a good local preserve maybe 15 minutes from the house, and those guys tend to be really great for us being able to show up and just get like 10 birds and have a good morning out of it.
You know, I'm glad to hear that. And do you realize how lucky you are to have a preserve that close to you?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Good. And, you know, so let's take that one for a minute, because I've been there and done that a million times as well. And I love every minute of it, because I'm all about the dogs. The dogs don't know the difference, at least in my opinion. And I've never seen science that tells me a dog knows the difference between a pen-raised pheasant and a wild pheasant. Yeah, some can behave differently. Okay, so don't send me any emails on that topic, everybody. But with a preserve so close, I wonder if you might consider this. 10 birds is a lot of birds. That dog is phoning it in by the last 6 or 7 birds. I wonder if you could buy 10 birds and then parcel them out over the course of 4 or 5 visits. And the reason is a dog, you know, my theory is, and I'm not the greatest trainer in the world, but I know other guys who are pretty great trainers, and they're feeling the same way. 15 minutes, 20 minutes drilling on any single topic for a dog is plenty. So if you can set up 3 birds in the right way and stage manage 3 birds at your hunting preserve so that your dog does them right, it's time to put them up and take them home. So, you know, practically speaking, maybe that's something you might be able to work out with a nearby preserve, especially if you're a neighbor and maybe you can pitch in a little bit in some other ways. That strikes me as really maybe your best alternative. Can you run your dogs on public land during the off season in North Carolina?
I believe you can. You can't release birds for training unless you meet some specific requirements like banding and sourcing. I think you have to have a special license or permit for it. Game bird propagator's permit, I think is what they call it.
Mm-hmm.
But the preserve out here has been nice enough to offer for some of the folks to come by during the off season and train there as well. So
yeah, I would take full advantage of that. And in the long run, it's going to cost you less. I can almost guarantee it. It's going to cost you less than going out and trying to find your own birds, keep them yourself, and then put them out and then watch them fly away and never come back. So. Yeah. So I would stick with that strategy, the preserve hunting strategy, only because it's so darn close and you know how lucky you are to have that. So good luck on that. Good luck on getting over whatever that bug is. And I hope the rest of your season goes well.
No, I appreciate it, Scott. Thanks.
Thanks for being on the Upland Nation.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. We have time for one more phone call in this first half of the show. And it is from Philip Urban. Philip, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Scott. I enjoy your program, definitely.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Please give me a 5-star review. They really do count. I appreciate that. Philip, you have a bird dog training / hunting question that I can relate to a lot, and I'll tell you that story in a minute. But why don't you ask the question so that we can get launched on the right foot?
Well, the question I have is what steps I can take to improve my shooting, specifically in reacting to quail, especially coming up. I'm having issues with that, missing far too many.
Yeah. Well, have you seen my TV show?
No, understood.
Okay. Well, you see, I'm the expert on that. And so glad to offer up some suggestions and some of them might help you as well. If it's about shooting while hunting, and particularly quail, it narrows it down a little bit. You know, half the battle with quail is that covey flush just gets your adrenaline going, and it's designed to freak a predator out. And so it does. And so the first thing I've done to rationalize my bad shooting in that regard is realize that you just got to get used to it. And so the only way to do that is to go out and do it more. You've heard the standard stuff, focus on one bird, not the covey, no flock shooting, et cetera, et cetera. I'm also a real big believer in something that I learned from a shooting instructor that I didn't know was a shooting instructor when I taught him how to fish a weighted nymph under a strike indicator on the Deschutes River about 25 years ago. When I found out he was an instructor, I said, all right, I taught you how to fly fish. Now you teach me how to shoot a bird. And he did. And his best advice was shoot like a predator. It's easy to say, but hard to do. And what he means by that is when you're ready to shoot, much like a great sporting clay shooter, you are focused on nothing but the target. You don't have blinders on, although some of the sporting clay shooters will literally do that, but focusing solely on a bird as it gets up. And looking, you know, the standard stuff, looking at the ring on the ring neck, the eye of the bobwhite, something at the front end, and not taking your eyes off it. Don't look at it. see it. That's number one. The other is take a lesson like I did. I've taken a lot more since and learned a lot more things about how to shoot. But a good instructor, and I mean a good one, not just some guy at the trap club, but a guy who knows how to teach shooting, will be able to figure out the one or two little niggling quirks that you have in your shooting style that may be holding you back. It might be gun mount. It might be the way you hold your head or the way you've got your weight balanced on the 2 feet. Those are things that I would look at. Have you explored any of those things, Philip?
I just informal. I think it's a good idea that I need to go to somebody professional to learn. I've even gone as far as going back to my original shotgun, thinking it would fit me better and I'd shoot better. And I did shoot a few more, but no, that's a good tip. I thank you for that.
Yeah, and you know, gun fit sometimes is overrated unless it's really wacky. You know, if it's really wrong in one way or another, I don't know, because a lot of the great shooters can shoot from behind their head or between their legs, and there's no such thing as gun fit, you know, in that case. So it's really the other things, and most of them are, you know, between your ears, I think. The other challenge you face is where you're looking when you're walking up on a dog. And again, this is different in a sporting clays course, but when you're walking up on a pointing dog or even, you know, just a flushing dog and you know there's birds on the ground, try this. Don't look at the ground and watch for the birds to flush. Look about head high or higher where the birds are probably going to go. Yeah, the odds are once in a while they'll squirt out the wrong way, but most of the time if your eyes are up, then your gun will be up too, and you won't have to try and catch up with a bird from ground level all the way up. We can never move our head, our arms, and our eyes as fast as a bird can get off the ground. So anticipate where the bird's going and look there as you're walking in on the bird.
Okay, understood.
Yeah, those are both good, and hopefully they'll work. What kind of dog you working with these days?
We raise German Shorthairs. So actually, when I traveled to Kansas, I took 14 of my own and just ran them in braces and hunted with other people. The one flush that came up, we actually had four dogs, one pointing and three backing on it. I stepped into it, and the bird just kind of wrapped around me. I missed the first shot as they crossed right to left, and when I turned around, I got one finally. Flying straight away, and I let out a big holler when I finally got one. So it was tough, but I still enjoyed the experience for sure.
Oh, the hair on the back of my neck is standing up just listening to that story. I'll tell you, that is so true. It really is. And good on you. I'm just glad I don't have your feed bill. Oh, geez. You know, that does bring up one extra tip. This is a bonus, no extra charge for this one, Philip. Most covey birds, as you just described, are pretty smart, and they're going to get out of there on the first flush. But there's always the slow one that took the short bus to the covey that day, who will wait a while, hoping you're just going to walk on past. You know, if you're with a bunch of other guys, sometimes it's more fun to let them empty their guns on that covey flush. You just wait for the last guy to get up in the air, and you're going to have that bird all to itself. And there's no way you can shoot at the flock because the flock's long gone.
No, understood. One of our hunting group, actually, he tended to do that, and his score was much higher than mine, for sure.
Well, there you go. Okay. Hey, I wish you luck, and it sounds like you got quite a life going there, 14 short hairs. Wow. Oh, we should call again when we talk about taking care of dogs. I bet you have learned a lot of things the hard way.
Over the years, for sure.
Well, good on you, and thanks for calling. Looking forward to next season already. I bet you are too. Thanks for being on the Upland Nation podcast.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, so hang on, because we've got a lot still to come here at the Upland Nation podcast. Some dog training advice for folks who can't find water. And Dr. Tim Hunt will be joining us to talk all things dog food, dog nutrition, dog conditioning, as well as let's take a little trip to New Mexico. It's all coming up right here on the Upland Nation. But first, Speaking of Dr. Tim, newest sponsor on the Upland Nation podcast, I've been using Dr. Tim's performance dog food for quite a while. It's all natural, and what finally convinced me is all the Iditarod race winners who are using Tim's food. Active dog food diets are built differently than other diets in that some of the factors and some of the ingredients become more important as a dog's metabolism kicks up a few notches. You can learn more all about all of that stuff and get 30% off your first order. Just go to Dr. Tim's, that would be DrTims.com, DrTims.com, and when you check out, just use the discount code UplandNation. And at ESPAmerica.com, I've reminded you once or twice in the past that I'm now using my ESP America hearing protection devices in the field as well as at the range for a whole bunch of reasons. What? Is that what you said? Well, maybe it's time for you as well. Anyway, check out the assortment of prices and capabilities at ESPAmerica.com. I guarantee you they will take good care of you with their custom-fitted hearing protection devices. I use them, and so should you. Now, don't go away. We've got a whole lot more to cover, including an extensive discussion on dog food, dog nutrition, and all the related topics with Dr. Tim Hunt. So keep that in mind. Also, we will be taking a quick trip to New Mexico in our public land access feature called This Land Is Your Land. And a dog training tip if you are having trouble teaching the duck search in the NAVDA program or hunt dead in any other program. Well, I'm going to have a suggestion that seems to be working for me in Flick, so stick around. In the meanwhile, speaking of Dr. Tim Hunt, they are our newest sponsor here at the Upland Nation podcast. I have been using Dr. Tim's food for a long time, and they're finally in a position to join up and tell the world about their products. And I've really become a believer in the last few years. Flick is one of those hard keepers. Tough to keep weight on him. He looks skinny even when I do all my best. But Tim's Momentum dog food seems to do the job for me, and it is one of the many choices on the drtims.com website. That's drtims.com. The clincher for me was the use by so many of the Iditarod winners. There's all sorts of other things to consider when you're looking at dog food, of course, but you can learn more about the formulations, the choices, the varieties, and why Tim's food is one of those five-star dog food advisor kind of products. Remember one other thing, if you will. You want a 30% discount on your first order. Don't forget to use the checkout code UplandNation at drtims.com. And as you well know, I said, as you well know, if you're having trouble hearing that, it's because you're probably already losing some of your hearing. You know, gunshots are probably one of the worst offenders. The only one worse might be standing next to a 737 as it's taken off. But if you'd like a custom fitted, fully guaranteed for your satisfaction solution to hearing loss, go to espamerica.com. Jack and his friends over there will take care of you. Custom fit right in the comfort of your own town. No chance to be a sideshow at one of those sportsmen's gatherings where you sit on the stool and everybody stares at you. Get them fitted in your own town. They're guaranteed. And believe me, you'll start using them not only at the range, but in the field as well. Handle It is the name of the feature where I learn stuff the hard way so you don't have to. In the NAVDA testing program, there is a component called the duck search. And as you can guess, it probably involves water. And in fact, it involves real complicated water, thickets and logs and all sorts of hiding places for a wing-clipped duck. The problem is many of us live in the desert, or we don't have good access to the right kind of testing water, as it were, but we can still teach a whole bunch of the other stuff that goes along with it, which becomes basically the hunt dead command everywhere except on the water. What it requires is your dog to think independently and extend the distance of the search. So in other words, if your dog is working right around you, he's not really extending. So the first thing you want to do is start teaching that dog to go further and further away from you in the direction you're facing, ideally. You do that by starting with a dead bird or a bumper that's got lots of scent on it, and keeping it close, but keeping it upwind of you so the dog is always smelling that motivation. Extend that distance, and continue to extend that distance. Once he's going way out there, then you can start moving it around so it's not directly upwind. The dog is in the habit of extending his search to begin with and then doing the work way down there. That's what you want. Start close. Work out. Remember the extension. Good luck. And hey, if you're doing a NAPTA test, double good luck. Good on you. All right, so here we are after all of that other stuff, finally getting around to talking with Dr. Tim Hunt, veterinarian, on the podcast. Tim, I've been using your food forever. I'm a believer. You're a believer too, of course. You went out and designed these foods, and I want to say foods with plural because there's a whole variety of them. Why did the world need another super premium natural performance dog food?
Well, when I started to get into sled dogs, I've been in sled dogs well over 20 years now, I had no real knowledge of nutrition, and I didn't understand how important nutrition was to the behavior and performance of a dog. And once I got into starting to race these sled dogs, and I was getting beat by guys that were 60 and women and all that other stuff that I'm embarrassed to say, but now I understand why, I started to look at the reasons why that was happening, why some young buck was getting smoked, and part of it was the nutrition of the teams that I was up against. So when I started to analyze what people were feeding, this was back in the mid-90s to 2000, we started to make our own foods in our garage with a cement mixer, actually, and we started to kind of put together some different variations of foods with different proteins and fats and blah, blah, blah. And that's where we came up with our first kibble, was back in 2004, because there just wasn't anything on the market that I found that would perform well under the stresses of these sled dogs without adding a whole lot of extra stuff to make it work. And my wife one day said, why don't you just put it all together instead of adding all this witch's brew? And she was right. I hate to say it, but she was. So going back to that, we made our first kibble in 2004, the Momentum, and we got it out into some different kennels and let them start to work with it and saw where it failed and where it worked, and then tinkered with that to get that perfected, and then we took off from there figuring out how to feed these sled dogs right. And if you can feed a team that goes across Alaska for 1,000 miles and 30 below weather, that kind of formulation can be then utilized for upland bird dogs and field trial dogs or frisbee dogs or dock diving dogs, for that matter. Dogs' metabolisms are pretty amazing. A lot different than ours. So in a nutshell, that's kind of how it all went down.
Yeah, well, I could relate to the cement mixer. It's probably how I first started brewing beer a while back. I've since graduated to the real stuff, but man, back in the day, you used what you had at hand. You know, you hit on something that this is my gripe about food, dog food, is, you know, everybody thinks they can do all sorts of things, cooking at home, raw diets, chopping it up, keeping it refrigerated. All that works great until you head out on the road for a 3-week hunting trip. And then all of a sudden, all of the convenience factors are gone again. It sounds like you've been through the same drill in the sled dog world. And you know, hey, thank you. We appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem. We've fed a tremendous amount of beef and meat over the years, too, in addition to kibble and all sorts of fats and oils and so on to try to improve on the performance, because they would go through a lot of calories. I mean, an Iditarod dog would go through 12,000 to 14,000 calories a day. that's like 30 Big Macs. You know, that's a lot of food. And when you're trying to get that to a dog and have solid stools at the end of the puzzle, it's a trick. So you learn how to compact this dietary need in smaller packages and yet make it very palatable, especially for a tired dog, a dog that's in adverse conditions. A lot of times, just like you and me, when you're out there working hard and when you're done, you really don't feel like eating. And the trick with dogs are you have to keep them eating to keep them going. That's the whole deal with a sled dog. And with a hunting dog, the same thing. You have to have a dog able and wanting to eat when you're done. Otherwise, the next day can be pretty flat.
Yeah, that is a real big issue with my young dog. He's the opposite of easy keeper, and I'm constantly dealing with that. And if you're hunting, and we'll talk more about this later, most people are disinclined to feed in the morning. So your dog is already halfway behind the curve before you've fed him for the night. So something that a dog will actually eat on a regular basis, even when they've got other things on their mind, is critical to us as much as it is to a musher. You know, of all of that, and you know, this is a question I've all, way back, I had a client in the dog food business, and lots of myths, lots of urban legends and all of that. What was the biggest challenge to formulating your variety of foods? Was it actually getting raw materials? Was it creating the actual ratios? What did you run up against?
It was the consistency of the production. I've gone through 7 different plants in the United States and 2 in Canada, 4 in Europe, to actually figure out how to get the food made right and consistently done without people pulling hijinks on you at the production level. So that's, to me, been the biggest obstacle, was getting consistent production with what I wanted in there on a consistent basis. So that was a trick. And, you know, we learned the hard way, and we had some hard times there when things kind of got changed on us without us knowing in the production. Now we have it all leveled out and very, very consistent production now for years. But early on, that was something that was very enlightening to me. You'd think you'd have a recipe and you could take it to 3 different restaurants and have it cooked the same, but it's not. And I would see, you know, one recipe at one plant made this way and another one at another plant made that way. And how that then performed in the dog was obvious. You could really see it. And with the sled dogs, they were perfect guinea pigs because they're at such a high RPM. Any variation in the food would show up quickly. It's like a high-end Formula One car. They have to have a certain type of gasoline in there. And if you start to put something that's lower octane, the car doesn't run right. And same with these sled dogs. So we could really see the cause and effect with that. So that, to me, was one of the biggest challenges there. Fine-tuning it somewhat was a challenge too, but I was able to get into and work with some real fine kennels with many dogs plus my own to really see how different variations of the diets would perform. But honestly, it was a production that was the biggest trick and really kept me in it, because there just is a lot of BS in pet food production, honestly.
Well, yeah, you don't have to tell me that. I see it every day. And, you know, the number one discussion everywhere on social media ends up devolving to dog food. If we were just to look for good ingredients versus bad ingredients, if you will, Tim, can you break it out into, you know, 2 columns like that?
Yeah, you can. And there's some simple things you can do at a base level to really start to understand diets. And one is the ash level of the diet. So ash is going to be the inorganic minerals that aren't combustible, like rock, okay, minerals, iron, selenium, calcium, phosphorus. Those are all minerals. And dogs need a certain percentage every day in their diet, let's say roughly 2%. And most minerals are going to be derived because the inclusion of your animal protein includes meat, that has bone on it or tendon, and those aren't digestible. So when you throw a whole chicken in a processor, you're going to get a lot more bone or ash as an end result than you would if you were able to take the meat or extract the meat off the bone. And you don't know what you're buying, but the ash content will denote to me how well the protein that was derived from the animal it was taken from. So to me, again, going back to that, you only need 2% ash in a diet to really complete all the minerals you need in a dog. but many diets will have 10-12% ash in there, and that to me is a true filler.
Yeah.
Because it's wasted space. And when I look at a formula for a dog food, I look at it like an orchestra. 100 seats, okay, 100% or 100 seats for 100 people playing an instrument. And I want to have everybody playing an instrument in those 100 seats if I can. And if I have a bunch of seats taken up by ash, then I'm wasting space that the consumer is paying for that isn't utilizable. So that's why some foods do cost more, because you take more time to derive your meat off the bone and your ash content's going to be lower, and ultimately that's what's going to benefit the dog. I know that was long-winded, but when somebody tries to break a food out, that's the first place I start, is wanted to ask about the ash content of the diet and see where it's at. And a good quality dog food should be in the 7 to 8% ash content. It's very, very difficult to get a dog food down to 2%, like I was saying, because of cost. But you can definitely get them in the 7 to 8% range and be cost effective.
When I was in the music business, the viola players got the brunt of our joshing. So in the orchestra, ash is the viola of the orchestra.
I love it.
Yeah. Now I'm going to make a joke out of it with my friend and viola joke archive this Friday night when we meet to chucker hunt. That brings up another one, and that is this whole thing of, I guess I'll call it meat versus meat meal. And can you just tell us what the difference is?
Sure. Meat meal is going to be a processed portion of the meat with the water taken out, so you can have a much more concentrated protein source. But it does go through a heating cycle of one time, and then you're going to put it through the extruder again, so it's going to be heated twice. So theoretically, some of the proteins might be heated twice and broken down where they're not available. Okay, and that's where the ash comes into play a little bit with trying to evaluate your quality. Now, with going with straight meat, there's going to be some things that will be cooked out of the food, plain and simple. There's some factors that just aren't going to sustain the heat of extrusion, but we can replace that somewhat with the combinations of different proteins that we put in there. Again, like I was saying before, in the sled dog world, we do use a lot of meat, and that's because there are some things we just can't gain in a straight kibble. But I really find that you could duplicate that fairly closely if you use a variety of different protein sources. So when I look at a meat versus a meat meal, I think meat meal definitely has a place, and we have to look at the level of performance that we're encountering. Okay, so if we're at a level of an Iditarod versus a field trial dog, you know, there are some gives and takes as to how we're going to feed those dogs, but I think you can make a very good food or kibble out of a meat meal without having a meat inclusion on the label.
What are the other good protein sources that we should look for when we're looking at the ingredients on a high-quality dog food?
Yeah, you know what? I'm not smart enough to always understand all the essential proteins, so the way I look at it is I like to get proteins from both air, land, and water. So I like a combination of things, because I think combinations allow you to have crossover, and it eliminates the possibility of being short on one. So I like something from the air, let's say chicken, something from the land, you know, that we're going to use, which could be pork, and then again something from the sea, which could be fish. So I like, to me, a combination of different animal proteins, and I'm a big believer in our protein sources in our food for our dogs need to come from another animal. Dogs are meant to eat other animals, okay? So if I see a sporting dog food that's heavily pea protein laden, that I know that dog's not going to perform that well over a dog food that's heavily animal protein based. And what I mean by that is if you have a 30% protein food, you want to have a percentage of that 30% as close to 100 as you can coming from an animal source. They just do better. And I've just seen that with these sled dogs and other performance dogs over the years, because they're carnivores, you know,
yeah.
they're meant for things. And they do eat plants, they can process things, so I should say they are really omnivores. But to me, I want a heavily animal protein-based food for a sporting dog.
You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. That's Dr. Tim Hunt, a veterinarian and the developer of Dr. Tim's Premium Dog Foods. I'm Scott Linden, your host, and thanks for staying with us, I guess, because I am fascinated by all of this, and particularly what you just alluded to, and that is so many dog foods have such long ingredient lists, and if you can stay awake to read all the way down to the last 10 or 12, oh, there's any number of things from blueberries to peas, like you said, and who knows what else is in there depending on where you are. Is there a role for any of that stuff at any time?
Well, if you're looking for an antioxidant source, you brought up blueberries, and blueberries are considered an antioxidant. To really get an adequate amount of blueberries in a dog food, you need about 20% of the bag filled with them.
Wow.
Okay, so they do offer antioxidant potential, but you just need to super concentrate it, so it's not practical. So there's much better better forms of antioxidants to use with sporting dogs, or any dog for that matter, than using blueberries, which is nice. It catches the consumer's eye. People get it. They know the taste, so they want to do right by their dog, but it just has to be really in there versus it just being window dressing, which I've always been against, is, you know, throwing something in a bag of dog food to catch the consumer's eye versus it actually having some function. So there are places for what you described, but they have to just be used judiciously and in an actual amount that does some good versus just gets the consumer to buy the food.
So where else are we going to get that?
I find ocean products are the best source for antioxidants. Fish oil,
yeah,
is tremendous for that. They bring in a number of antioxidants that way. Some of the actual preservatives in the food will convey some antioxidant potential to the dog as well. Vitamin C, selenium. I like astaxanthin, resveratrol. All of these things can come through different ocean sources of products, and that's why we include them in the diet too.
Great. So,
and that really helps with recovery, is to use these levels of antioxidants either in the food or extra as a supplement.
Well, you know, you just mentioned a word I was going to ask you about later. Let's talk a little bit about the hunting process and then the post-hunting process. So I get up in the morning, this Saturday morning, I'm going to get up and I'm going to put on my warm clothes and my really serious boots because we're going to be hunting in the snow. Okay. Do I feed my dog then or do I wait?
So great question. This is where people always go to, and they forget about all the training that goes up to that point. So getting back a few steps, to me, dogs are creatures of habit. So when you're in training with your dog, you're going to feed him the same way as when you go hunting. So if you're working your dog on the days off a certain way and you're feeding at that time, I would stick with it with that hunting day too. So on the training days, if you feed in the morning and then hunt 3 hours later, do that. If you train and then feed in the afternoon, stay with that. And I think that helps for several reasons. One is the whole bloat idea of feeding at the wrong time causing their stomach to flip. I find that happens more times with dogs that are fed out of routine than with routine, okay? And it can be a volume thing, how much they eat, and some other things can come into play too. But I just like to keep the routine the same for that consideration. Number two is it gets their system set up for when they do get into a hard performance day, like when you're going out with your super boots and it's snowy and the day is rougher than normal, you've already had them out training, and their body's used to this rhythm of when they eat, how they process the food, and so on. So this needs to be established in your training cycle before you decide on Saturday to go out. If you don't really have a training cycle, I would tend to not feed the dog the morning of. I like to feed dogs 4 hours or greater before performance or the night before, okay, as a rule. But it goes all the way back to your training. You have to just get the dog used to whatever rhythm you have with your feeding schedule and when they go out and do work. So I would keep whatever you were doing prior to your Saturday outing with your pink, you know, super boots that you wear, consistent.
Yeah, that's great advice. And you also brought something up that I need to remind listeners of, and that is, you're not just a guy who's developed a dog food and races sled dogs. You're a practicing veterinarian, so you see all this stuff, whether it's bloat or anything else related to nutrition and conditioning. This is the stuff that you see on a day-to-day basis, right?
Yeah, exactly. I run a full-time vet practice in Marquette, Michigan. We've got 5 veterinarians. We're busy. We see emergencies. So I get to see all of these things, and I've been a vet over 30 years now, working in a small animal setting. So all of these things aren't new, and over the years of seeing these bloat dogs, you know, the wonder is, why does this happen? And there's still a lot of questions as to why. But one thing, at least with telling fellow sporting dog enthusiasts is just to really stay with your method of feeding, your timing, and don't vary from it, because that can really set things off with their whole digestive tract.
Well, I believe that. Well, let's go to the end of the day. The guns are put up. We've had our toast. Is the dog eating dinner right then, or are we waiting a certain amount of time after he's put up? And what do we do after the hunt for our dogs?
Yeah, and this comes into a really good area, too. Again, going back to the whole training scenario, I keep it consistent with how you do it in your training timing. The one thing people go wrong, and they always complain about Sunday flat dogs, okay? The dogs are just toasted on Sunday, and part of that is their glycogen reserves get used up on day one and don't get replenished properly. And many out there listening might be familiar with glycogen replenishment. And what that means are the muscles use glycogen as their first line of energy, and they get used up quickly. And you can train the muscles to kind of acquire more glycogen, build bigger stores with proper training and how you feed them. But it's also really timed to the timing of feeding after the cessation of exercise. So you want to get glycogen replenishment into that dog within typically 30 to 90 minutes post-exercise being done. And that's not super complicated. If you go out there and start looking for it, you can find different recipes for using maltodextrin, which is similar or exactly the same, I should say, as your beer-making days that you talked about earlier. And we just feed that to the dog, and that's a quick replenishment for the dog for the glycogen. And then you give them another hour, and then I feed them. I usually like to feed my dogs, oh, I would say 1 to 2 hours post-exercise, but I often try to do some sort of a glycogen replenishment prior to that if they'll accept it. And as I was talking about before, a lot of times they're tired and sore, and those dogs won't want to take these things we want them to take. So we have to train them to take this stuff. And that's where training comes in, too, is you expose them to this in a non-hunting setting so they accept it. And feeding, especially in sled dog world, and same goes with field trial dogs, feeding is all training. You train them to eat and take these things. But the window of timing is real important for the glycogen first, and then feeding, I usually go about 2 hours post-exercise.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I keep it consistent, and I've never had a dog twist their stomach doing that, but I always keep it the same.
Yeah. Well, my concern about feeding once a day is we feed too much, and then you're back into that bloat risk a little bit. You know, one of the products I really believe in is called GlycoCharge, and I like that because it, I'm told, Flick says it tastes like liver. And so he's more inclined to take it up right after a hunt. And that is, of course, one of the critical factors you just alluded to. It's probably true of all sorts of other products out there, but that one seems to work for me.
It's a good product.
Tell me a little bit about this whole, you know, now we're back to everything's full circle. Now the grain-free versus the food that do have grains, whatever, however we define that. What's the latest on all of that?
The latest is still the jury is out on this. A lot of veterinarians are still really uncertain, and people in the nutrition sector, that this is a real deal with the numbers that are being shown and some of the data that's been put out there. So we're still waiting for more research. So I'm definitely staying aware of what's going on with the whole grain-free dilated cardiomyopathy concerns. Many people have dropped off using grain-free, which is fine. I understand that because of what's been put out there. You have to take it with a grain of salt, what you're reading on the internet. It can really take a life of its own, and this one sure has. And I think the government came out a little bit quick on this with some of their recommendations here. So we'll have to see where this goes. But to me, I think there's ways to make a grain-free food very safe and fed to a dog. My personal belief with grain-free over the years has been that it's a good food allergy type dog. And we always use grain-free diets because of dogs being allergic to grains, not because it's some superfood over a grain. I don't see a great deal of difference between the two. They both bring carbohydrates to the mix. So to me, going back to grains would be fine versus staying on the grain-free, just out of rotation even for that matter. But I don't see grain-frees as inherently evil if they're formulated well. Okay, there are diets out there grain-free that were formulated terribly, which could lead to problems, and those were identified years ago but stayed on the market. And maybe that'll take some of this really bad formulation of diets out of the people's Oh, buying ability, without them knowing that they're buying something that shouldn't be really fed to their dog.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things I recall reading some of the summaries of the science. I wouldn't know how to read the science, but the sample sizes on the research are small, and also there is some debate over what is actually causing the problem, if anything is causing the problem.
Correct. Yeah, there's a lot of theories on that. And honestly, I really think the jury's out. I mean, it's something may have come about and people became aware of it. And I've seen diseases over the years, too, that suddenly became apparent because we figured out how to diagnose them.
Mm.
So, again, I'm not trying to save my own skin with our grain freeze by any means. You know, looking at this objectively and making sure I would create foods only that I would feed to my own dogs is how I do it. And I'm just not convinced right now that all grain freeze are evil. It
right.
just depends on how you formulate it.
Well, you brought up a point that I remember being indoctrinated over many, many, many decades ago, and that is rotating protein sources periodically. Where does that fit into a bird dog owner's regime?
Well, the rotation plan is more of an allergy theory, that if you expose a dog to certain proteins only for a length of time that's short, they don't develop a problem against it. So if you go on one protein for several months and then switch them over to another and then another, it's not long enough to develop a so-called food allergy to that protein. There might be some credence to it with a small percentage of dogs, but overall, I think the variety of rotation is more interesting to the dog owner than necessarily to the dogs. I mean, dogs like changes, but, you know, overall rotation diet to me isn't a panacea, but there might be some dogs that can benefit from it that do have a history or a potential for a food allergy. I think that's where it stems from.
I'm seeing some corollaries here. You know, the dog food ingredients and even the bag and the design of the bag are designed to attract dog owners, not dogs. Like fishing lures, they're designed to attract fishermen, not fish.
Absolutely. You should go to some of these pet shows where they have all the companies together. It's overwhelming, and it's really something else to see. They really are set up just like you say. The bags are like fishing lures.
Mm.
You just slowly have to learn and understand what you start to look for on a bag of food, you know, how to read an ingredient panel, what kind of ingredients you're seeking, what percentage of protein and fat, and what types of fats we're using, what types of fiber we're using. You know, a sporting dog food is built in a certain way because we're trying to fit a square peg into a square hole, and there's a lot of good foods out there, but they're not meant for a sporting dog, and the reasons they don't work well is because it leads to a soft stool. So if we go back to the whole idea of a sporting dog, why is that food meant for that dog that's running outside, you know, chasing the pheasants that you're dropping? They need to poop solid, and the poop tells you everything. If you have solid poop, when the dog is performing, that food is meant for that performance. It really is as simple as that. Okay.
Okay. Now I'm going to sound like a third grader, but how does a solid poop reflect a dog food's performance in a performance dog?
Sure. It's going to show to me proper digestion.
Yeah.
So it all starts with the colon of the dog. If we can get the colon to work right, and that's job of the colon is to extract water and form a good solid poop, then it means everything upstairs is working correctly. And there's ways to mask it a little bit, but for the most part, foods that are performing well will allow solid poops to happen. And if the colon works right, then everything upstairs is working right. And I don't want to get too deep into it, but it's all about how quickly that food can go through the GI tract and get digested and absorbed, and then leads to a good solid poop. So to me, evaluating a food is really looking at that stool quality, both when he's not doing anything and both when he's performing. It needs to stay solid.
Great. Thank you. That's enlightening. And while the subject may not be the most fun subject to have discussion about, especially in mixed company, it does clear things up a little bit. Speaking of that sort of stuff, though, and you alluded to it again, and boy, this is fascinating to me. There are good and there are bad ingredients. Outside of the protein sources, is there a dirty dozen of other things that we want to make sure we try and avoid in a dog food?
Yeah, you know, one thing you can look at is poorly made dog foods are going to use enhancers for palatability or the dog to eat it that don't need to be there. For instance, one is molasses. Okay, people always wonder, why is molasses in that dog food? It's because it's a taste enhancer. Dogs like sweet. So if you throw that in there, you can make a really crummy food taste good, and they'll eat it. So to me, one way to look at a food is to look at what kind of flavor enhancers they use, and molasses is one example of a very inexpensive dog food masking agent. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's those kind of tricks that you'll see. I think when you read a label, it should specify what it is. So if it says animal meal, what animal is it? Is it a whale? Is it a zombie? You know, is it Sasquatch or is it a pig? You know, so when I see things that are very broad term like animal meal or animal fat, it makes me scratch my head and I don't like it. I like to know exactly what I'm feeding my dog. So I think you need very defined terms to explain what the ingredients are versus very broad terms. So that's another example that I see quite often too, is a very broad definition of whatever's in there.
You know, there are some, and I'll just call them grocery store brands that are still using all sorts of other sketchy ingredients as a protein source. Back in the day, it was feathers and bones and things like that. Are people still doing that sort of thing?
Yeah, feather meal will still make its way into diets. Often it's going to be put in chicken meal, and if it's under a certain level, they don't have to list it. That's one way you can get a higher percentage chicken meal is often by using feather meal, but it's not listed. But often the feather meal will come through because you'll see feathers actually in the kibble. Okay, so, you know, some will say feather meal has some validity to it. I'm not a big fan of using processed feather meal as a protein source. When I see dogs eat things, I usually kind of tear it apart, don't you, and kind of eat the breast of the chicken or whatever it might be. So I don't see it as highly digestible sourcing of protein.
I guess that leads to this kind of final question, and that is, if we have a performance dog that we expect to work hard 1, 2, 3, 4 days a week, depending on how lucky we are, I guess. What is the minimum fat versus protein versus carbohydrate ratio that we probably ought to feed?
Yeah, I would definitely start no lower than a 30% protein and a 20% fat.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's going to take your carbohydrate range around the low 30s, depending on the ash content and the moisture and everything else and the fiber that's in there. But to me, a 30-20 is the place I would begin with a sporting dog food. Then I look at the fiber types. And certain fibers definitely work better in a sporting dog than others, so I would consider some sort of a moderately fermentable fiber. A good fiber to use, like beet pulp, is a very good fiber for a sporting dog. It helps digest and it slows transit time, and it's easy on the colon when they do poop. It doesn't cause bloody stools, for instance, which can happen under stress. The other thing people do wrong a lot, Scott, is this, is they start these high-end foods right when they start hunting. And the dog has to convert or transition over to a food, and it takes a while. And I had to prove this to myself early on in my career of sled dogs, in that if you transition the dog over to this higher-fat protein food at least a month ahead in training, their body sets up for the training. And I was able to, when I started to finally realize this and didn't go to a cheap food in the off-season, I was able to speed up my training curve by 1 month. I took a month off my training time with my sled dogs once I stayed with the same food year-round. It costs more, but I saw it in the fall with my training just drastically improving. The dogs just performed. And dogs are meant to be fed on fat. Their metabolism runs on fat. Ours runs on carbohydrates more than fat. So if you keep the fat quantity up, the percentage, but not necessarily the amount, so your calories are staying down and they don't get fat in the summer, their bodies really are keen to exercise. And once you start to bring them into the fold of doing more, they just click into it way quicker than if they have to convert both over to a new food and then start training at the very same time. So at least a month ahead of when you start to train your dogs for hunting and such, that's when you need to change your food if you don't stay on it year-round.
Great. Yeah, I remember being convinced of that in Larry Mueller's book many, many years ago, and have never gone back.
Yeah. It's an eye-opener.
It is. It really is. But speaking of high protein, is there a reason for us to go up above 32-34%, and what would that reason be?
Yeah, the main reason with that often tends to be you want to drop your carbohydrate levels somewhat, because with carbohydrates, the digestibility of your carbs can come into play with high sporting dogs, in that they can't process them as quickly as a protein. So to me, going to a higher protein food, moderately or higher fat food, will drop my carbs down, and then their digestion improves. So to me, it's about not so much more protein, it's about dropping the carb load, okay, in your diet.
Yeah.
Now, it's not going to be harmful for a dog, you know, to have a so-called too hot food. You're not going to cause kidney disease with too much protein. Protein drives the cost of the food. That's the main impetus for why a dog food might cost more than the next one, is the protein level and type. So you might pay more for that, but I find that that does improve the overall stool quality when we drop the carbohydrate amount.
Great. Now, if like me, you really want to supplement a dog's intake with a good fat, because I'm a big believer.
Sure.
I was convinced of that many years ago. If I want my dog to take in more fat, whether it's during the hunting day or that night so they can process it overnight, what are some of the high-quality fat sources that we might want to carry with us?
Sure. It depends on your temperature. So to me, the fat source is going to be dictated by where I'm working my dog. So if I'm working in 30 below weather, it's going to be different than 30 above with my fat source. I might use beef when it's super cold, and I might use chicken when it's warmer. Okay, it's how it's processed and how the dog responds to it. So to me, I look at melting points of fat and use that as a guideline to make it a little easier to understand this. The higher melting point fats, okay, are usually easier to feed when it's colder. Okay, and the lower melting point ones I usually use when it's warmer. And it's the ease of by if you have a chicken fat sitting out, it gets all slimy when it's sitting on your kitchen counter, right?
Yeah.
But if you have beef sitting there, it takes a lot longer for it to go. So that has a higher melting point in my mind. So I usually use the harder fats when it's colder and the softer fats when it's warmer.
Now you did
so that's
not.
How I kind of. And again, you want to expose the dog to this in training, and you can give too much fat way easy.
Oh, yeah.
So you have to ease it in. So to me, that's where I would tend to go with it.
Now, you didn't mention anything like butter, olive oil, canola oil, or any of the other plant-based choices out there. You prefer animal fat sources as well?
I usually do. And you can use corn oil. You know, coconut oil has its place too, but in small amounts. But again, when you use plant-based oils, you just can't use too much of it. You can run into some problems with a lot of plant-based oils over a long time where you can actually drive some deficiencies in the dog. So I'm a little cautious with that. But again, I have used corn and canola oil over time. Here's an interesting fact. If you want to increase your fat amount in your diet to your dog by 3%, you give him 1 tablespoon of any sort of vegetable oil. We'll give you 3% more fat. So 1 tablespoon equals, here's 3% more calories to your dog. But again, if you just hit them with that too much, the next day you're going to have the skids on the dog out the back end. You have to go light with it and again, get it in on training. Let them see it when they're training to get their body used to it.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? I never thought about training your dog to eat, but they need to learn just about everything. You're precisely right.
And where people go way wrong on that end of things, Scott, because we're going all over the place today, is when the dogs are young, when they're puppies, never feed them too much. Where people go wrong and they get picky dogs is because they fed them too heavy as a puppy, and they realize the next meal's coming and it's going to be a big one again, and the next one's coming and it's a big one. So they start off with the Walton family, right? And they have got like 9 siblings when you're Labrador, and then suddenly you come into the home where it's just him and nobody else, and then they have these loving parents, and they start to feed the dog because they're Italian mothers and fathers, and they feed them too much, and suddenly you're starting to leave food behind. And that's what develops a picky eater, is when they're young, under 4 months of age. So you keep them thin, and you keep them hungry, and they learn to eat, and then when you're working them hard in the field and they're tired, they have that instilled in them that when the food dish comes out, I better eat it because I might not get the next one anytime soon.
I love it. Well, we could talk all day, but it's past dinner time for both of us, so I'm going to turn you loose. That's Dr. Tim Hunt. His company is Dr. Tim's Premium Dog Foods. You can find out more about that whole variety of choices out there at drtims.com, drtims.com. Wow, we'll do this again sometime, and maybe we'll get into some other veterinary questions the next time, although this has just been enlightening for me. I sure appreciate your being part of the Upland Nation podcast.
Thanks, Scott. I really appreciate the opportunity. You have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
All right, get ready for your trip to New Mexico. It's coming up next on the Upland Nation. But before we do, let me just rail one more time on the wonderful experience I'm having. I don't know if Flick would agree, with my Dogtra T&B dual collar system. Two collars, one handheld transmitter that has two sets of buttons, so you're not trying to press on the screen and toggle back and forth. It is working great for us. You can use it with your gloves on. It's got incredible battery life. And also, if you go to Dogtra.com and buy anything of $200 or more in value, you can get 10% off plus free shipping. Just use the code SLUN10 at checkout. Hey, this land is your land, and this is my chance to share with you some of the places I've been that I think you might enjoy. This time of year, who isn't thinking about the southwestern United States? We had the pleasure of going down to the Deming, New Mexico area a couple years ago to make a Wing Shooting USA episode, and had a great time. First off, because it was winter and we were warm. And second off, because I got to chase a couple less common scaled and gambles quail species. It's a harsh and unforgiving environment surrounding that Deming area. It's all desert. Some of it's higher elevation than others, and there's hills and valleys, but it's all desert. And the good news about that is the Bureau of Land Management is administering so much of that stuff right there. You take out a topo map, all that yellow country is open to you and me. And some of it holds gambles and scaled quail. You can't go wrong heading up into any of those regions that have a little bit of a mountain range that you can hunt up to or into some of those valleys and gullies and that sort of thing. Look for arroyos, sand-covered arroyos, where the sand is soft enough for you to see some of the tracks that the birds will leave behind. It's a run-and-gun sort of experience, so if you aren't ready for a chase, well, then maybe you ought to go back to Bob White's. No, just kidding. You can do it. We can do it. Flick had a great time. He was just a little guy way back then. But you won't get a lot of classic dog work, but you will get some fascinating vistas as well as some interesting hunting. It's all near Deming, New Mexico. Take out a map and take a look. And one place to learn more about that, I'll give you more details soon, at my new website, findbirdhuntingspots.com. Win a pointer over and under shotgun while you're there. Just sign up for the mailing list. I am doing my best to help you find places to hunt so that you will stay a hunter and maybe recruit another one. Now, I'm not going to give you the latitude and the longitude, but I'm going to give you some ideas, just like this land is your land feature here. Go to Deming, go to this place, go to that place, and start your search. It's all at findbirdhuntingspots.com. And thank you one more time. I encourage you to learn more about hearing loss and how you can prevent it at espamerica.com. Custom fitted, espamerica.com. Take a look at their assortment and then consider investing in your own hearing. Well, that's about going to do it here at the Upland Nation podcast. Thank you to Dr. Tim Hunt. Thank you to all the callers with all of their tough questions for me. I hope I was helpful in one way or another, or at least got you started in the right direction. If you are a listener and you like what you hear, please leave a review wherever you get your podcast, because that kind of stuff really matters. Tell your friends, of course, but the best way to tell them is to leave a review and a rating. Podcasts are all over the place, and we're trying to be the best in the business. It helps if you will provide some feedback. You can do that at the Upland Nation Facebook page, the Wing Shooting USA Facebook page, or you can always drop me a note at scottlindenoutdoors@gmail.com. I promise never to insult your intelligence and waste your time. I know how tough it is to find time to hunt or look for hunting places. My job is to help you enjoy yourself outdoors, save you time, save you effort, and encourage you to go again. So thanks again for listening. I'm Scott Linden. Have a great day outdoors.